Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and I'm joined by Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone.
And Randy Olson.
Hello again.
And joining us, hopefully, will be Sergeant Major Herb Friedman, who's trying to call in. We're having some technical difficulties. And hopefully Taylor Ackerman will be joining us as well. But today's show is titled Leaflet Bombs and Flying Loudspeakers, Psychological Warfare During the Korean War. And this show is the fifth in a series focused on looking at the Korean War. If you've been with us these past few weeks, you know that we have been focused on the sky, using this foundational treatise, The Barbarization of the Sky by Bertha von Suttner, written in 1912, and entering the forest of the so-called Forgotten War through the sky. So we have been talking about aerial bombardment in both the South and the North, and also dropped from the skies during the Korean War were millions of pieces of paper carried in what are called leaflet bombs, and airplanes were also outfitted with loudspeakers. And these messages carried by airplanes were part of the psychological warfare or Psy War campaign during the Korean War. There is an article on our show resources page called Air Force Psychological Warfare in Korea, and there are a number of resources on our show resources page, so I encourage you to dive into those resources. And that's a pretty short article, and in that article as well, it's very interesting because the author not only talks about these millions of pieces of paper being dropped from airplanes and also via artillery, but also the Air Force itself, airplanes themselves, had this psychological impact. So this is a very broad way of looking at Psy War, looking at the U.S. Air Force's operations during this Psy War campaign. So it's not just these messages, but also the Air Force itself, which was very intimidating. So I think we may have Sergeant Major Friedman on the line. Is that you? Sergeant Major Friedman?
Yes, I've made it somehow.
Okay, amazing. Miracles never cease. So.
Hello.
Well, welcome to Virtues of Peace, and thank you so much for being here and sharing your expertise on Psy War and Psy War during the Korean War. And Sergeant Major Friedman has over 160 articles on Psy War in various conflicts, not just the Korean War. And so you can find his articles at PsyWarrior.com, and we've put a link to some of his articles on our show resources page at VirtuesOfPeace.com. But Sergeant Major Friedman, can you just begin by telling us a bit about yourself and how you came to write all of the articles on Psy War found at PsyWarrior.com?
Well, that's going to be tremendously boring, and I would suggest if I just go on too long, somebody tell me just shut up. I'm not sensitive.
Right.
Let me warn you about my voice first. I've been screaming at troops at 5 in the morning on a cold PT field while they did calisthenics for about 20 years. This is the result. Let me also warn you, in general, there are no definitive answers. This is an art, not a science. It's sales. It's marketing. Some people can sell ice to Eskimos. Others cannot close a deal, no matter how good. Keep that in mind. Every answer we give is an opinion. Okay, now back, let's talk a little bit about Psy War in general. The Army always changes names. In World War I, you got shell shock. In World War II, you got battle fatigue, and in Vietnam, you got PTSD. So you might ask, what's the difference? Well, there is no difference. You know, it's just the words. Our field that we're going to talk about was first called propaganda. That comes directly from the Catholic Church. Then it became psychological warfare because it was used during warfare. Then psychological operations because it was also used in non-war situations such as floods and earthquakes. And then eventually it became military information support operations, which is MISO. Everybody hated it because it was a green Japanese soup. And now they basically brought it back to PSYOP. Now, maybe let me, should I stop here now if anybody want to talk, or should I keep on?
It's great, but I just, if you could just talk a little bit about yourself. We always like to have a little bit of info about our guests.
Next.
And you in particular, like it's just, you have written so much about this topic, and you're, you know, a walking encyclopedia, and we're always interested in how people come to this. And if you could talk a little bit about that story, I don't think I know a little bit about it. I don't think it's boring at all. So please.
Yeah. I came to it through the back door, six or seven decades ago. I was walking down 34th Street in New York City, with a ticket to Madison Square Garden. And as I'm walking, I see in a window a large photograph of a stamp of Adolf Hitler, and his face was a skull. So I was fascinated. I went inside. I immediately traded the ticket for that. That led to about 30 articles on propaganda stamps because I'm kind of a bulldog and I tend to be obsessed. And I ended up winning a gold medal in a big exhibition. And probably the only best of show ever given in a stamp exhibit with no real stamps. I don't believe that could happen today. I think the rules are too steep. Then I kind of felt like I'd mastered that, so I started looking at banknotes because I was really interested in government documents that were forged or counterfeited or parodied or made jokes. So I did the same exact thing. I started studying banknotes, and I ended up writing about 30 articles. I pretty much covered that field. I should probably say in the stamps, I also wrote about 30 articles. I don't even count those among the other things that we talk about. That was just kind of a beginning. I'm going to kind of leave out the military. There was a school. There was a school for PSYOPs and all, but Then a military buddy who was a major asked me if I'd write a story on his website. That was Psy Warrior, the one that you mentioned earlier. I did so. It was very popular. And then other units began asking for a story about their units. Then suddenly veterans of other wars, veterans of Great Britain and Israel and Rhodesia, all wrote to me, and they wanted articles. And so I studied each of those. Having the ability to get to military information at that time, because I did have a classification that allowed me to read a lot of documents. And I also wrote a lot of stories on a British friend's site, which is PsyWar.org. Looking at the Psy Warrior site, which you mentioned again, I've got about 55 articles on general subjects, about 37 on recent war, maybe 33 on Vietnam, maybe about 11 on Korea, and then about 37 on World War II and 4 on World War I. So you could basically read my stuff and get a PhD on the subject. I'm kind of famous only because nobody else cares about the subject. Nobody in the world writes about it, really, and these days. And the fact that I've been regularly writing and updating the articles makes them pretty popular. And
caught our attention.
Well, every time there's a new war, I get 100 phone calls from BBC and Canadian and CNN, and everybody wants to talk about it whenever the bombs are dropping. And then when it gets a little peaceful, we don't hear anything. As soon as the bombs drop, we get knocked off the air. We get like 10,000 emails a day, and it knocks us right off the internet, which I always thought was kind of funny. But PSYOP itself has never been regarded much by the Army. The combat officers basically want to kill people. They don't want to waste their planes dropping paper. They don't want to waste artillery shooting paper. They would rather just blow them to hell. And PSYOP really, there's really no way to show how successful it is. Now, I've gone to dozens of lectures in the military, and there are certain people, mathematicians, that say, well, we can define anything. We have formulas that will tell us if a project works. But the reality of it is that nobody knows exactly why it works, and nobody knows when it will work. So, and the Army has not even kept many of their own records. Last year, a lot of the old PSYOP units from the Vietnam all had anniversaries. They made four battalions during the Vietnam War. And I've got on my wall, I'm just looking at certificates of achievement from the 1st Battalion, from the 5th Battalion. And the reason for that is they could not celebrate their own units because they didn't know their own history, because nobody had thought it was worth saving. At the end of World War II, it was all canned. At the end of the Korean War, it was all canned. So every time there's a new war here, we reinvent the wheel. And now, again, I'm going to catch my breath, and if you have any comments, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I have a question, but I'll open it up to the other hosts. Anybody have a question or comment? Going once.
I do. I'm interested in... I'm interested in trying to get down to making sure we're all operating from the same sort of basic set of definitions, because I think I understand what we mean when we use terms like psychological warfare. Like I can understand etymologically what those words might refer to, but you know, having just a foundational set of ideas so that when we say these words, we are all talking about the same things, would be useful. And Sergeant Major Friedman, would you mind helping me understand perhaps the distinction between like destruction of an enemy morale versus like, you know, bolstering friendly morale, and like how those all factor into psychological?
Okay. That pretty much comes up a little bit later when we talk about tactical and strategic and consolidation. It's very important. Well, let me pick Vietnam, because that's more recent. We can really talk about it. In Vietnam, we needed the enemy to surrender because we found out it was some insane price, and again, you can read one of my articles and find out, but it cost about $2,000, it might be, you know, $20,000 to kill an enemy soldier when you think of all the artillery and the bombs and the fuel, and you could drop a piece of paper and he'd quit. So the Cy War basically, number one, from a standpoint of killing people, it allowed us not to kill them, and it allowed them not to shoot at us. Because we made offers, and it was expensive. We would tell in Vietnam a soldier, if you come over to our side, we will, number one, we will give you a hot meal, a bath. We will medically treat you. We know you're out in the jungle there, and you've got malaria and a half a dozen untreated diseases. We will cure you. We will bring you back to perfect health. We will give you good food. We will educate you. We will teach you a trade you want. We will give you the lumber to build a house. And that's just a small part of it. That sounds like a big deal. But about 200,000 soldiers, we think, came in through the Chu Hoi program, which is sometimes translated as open arms. In Iraq, there were like 26 divisions of very well-trained and experienced Iraqi troops sitting in Kuwait. We took them out in 100 hours, and we used the PSYOP for that. And how do we do it? We did not allow them to sleep. We kept planes over them all the time, constant noise. We broke their communications. We stopped their supply. They couldn't eat. They couldn't drink. They just sat there by themselves, and we constantly told them, we're coming, we're coming. We lied to them. We told them we're going to invade you by sea. In fact, we came by land. But the result of all of this, just when we get to the bottom line, is we think about 100,000 Iraqis just basically threw on their weapons and walked back to Iraq. Now, we don't know. Nobody's sure because a lot of them were killed in the field. A lot of them were buried by tanks with shovel noses that just covered over their trenches. But we think about 100,000 just left. So that's what you do to the enemy. You make them quit. You make them give up. Now, it only works if they're beaten. It doesn't work if they're feeling good. There's no psyop in the world that would stop German tanks racing across France in World War II because they thought they were the super race and they thought they were invincible. But if you get them where they're tired and they're hungry and they've taken a couple of beatings and they're looking around and they're seeing a lot of injured people, then like little, just like drops of water on a rock, psyops will work. But it takes that. If they're not beaten, it doesn't work. And, you know, that's a horrible thing to say, but it's the reality. Now, why do you want to help your own people? Well, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just wanted to interject, and I want to try to get Korea in here somehow. But this like, you get them when they're weak idea. As you and I discuss, Sergeant Major Friedman, there's a book on Psy War in Korea by Stephen Pease, P-E-A-S-E. And he makes this point, surrender is a process. And that stuck out to me, that there's this campaign over time to just erode the will and get the person to surrender. And I can't help, as you know, I'm a philosophy professor, and I can't help but connect this to these ideas that we get from Immanuel Kant about the will. So there's like the will, and then there are these inclinations that we have. And so there's such a, you know, you're being pulled to quit because you're tired, you're hungry, you've got planes dropping bombs on you, and like this will to fight is slowly being eroded away. And just to make this connection to Kant's philosophy, there's like this will, this like determination, and I guess, you know, German tanks during World War II are the apotheosis of that. Like that's just not going to be moved at all. And then there's like this inclination to quit and this desire to just stop. And I just wanted to make that point. And then over back to you, Sergeant Major Friedman, if you want to follow up on that or not.
No, that's terrific. No, you're exactly right. And Japan is a perfect example. Mm. They just never quit. They were bombed. Mm. They were just killed by the thousands. They were firebombed. General LeMay once said, "If we lose this war, I'm going to be killed as a war criminal." You know, we firebombed cities. We actually tried to get a fire tornado. We loved the idea of the flame that would take the oxygen right out of their lungs. So, but again, this only works, this whole idea of psychological warfare only works if they're beaten, and they have to know they're beaten. Because when they're strong, and one of the reasons it didn't really work that well on the Vietnamese is that those people come from down the north, they were lied to by their own country. They were told they were going down there to liberate the South. They would be welcomed with open arms. When Tet came, Tet was a horrible disaster for the North. There's not even any real record of how many people were killed. We think about 34,000 were killed, and we basically wiped out the Viet Cong military at that time. But they simply told their people, well, we won. The people loved us. The people came out. And by the way, Kim still tells his people that we invaded Korea, that we started the war. Never mentioned that he sent close to 100,000 troops and 100 Russian tanks down south. So if you have total control of the news, you could tell the people anything, and there's a good chance they'll believe you. In Iraq, we wanted the new government to take power, so we started advertising their army. We told them people how wonderful their army was, how heroic they were. We made comic books about their army. We wanted the people to vote. We wanted them to get a feel for the democratic process. So we literally pushed the elections. We told them, you have to vote. We dropped leaflets showing women standing with a big smile and a blue thumb. And that was because you went to vote, they wanted to make sure you only voted once. So you put your thumb in ink. So this is part of that second part of that question. This is how you You get the people behind you. You consolidate the government. You tell them things are better now. We got rid of the tyrants. We killed the Diem. We killed the pretty much, you know, the only man that might have won in Vietnam, who was a real patriot, but he wasn't. He didn't meet our standards. He wasn't willing to put on the Indian headdress and kiss babies because he was French and he was, you know, he was well trained by the French and he was very, very formal. So basically, he was just taken out of the picture. Now, I don't know why I threw that in, but I just got carried away.
Well, I mean, just
we're going way off, you know, we're kind of way off the track of where we were going to be. Go ahead.
It's all good. I mean, you're addressing the strategic, tactical, and consolidation stuff before we get to it, but it's all good because, as Bertha von Suttner says, it takes really three passes to understand something. So that was our first pass. But let's dial back to the Korean War. And I read also that sort of we were there very early, like before the troops even arrived, the U.S. troops, there was paper dropped in the Korean War. So doubtless there was some foundation laid. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how the Psy War and the Korean War came about, and were there units in World War II involved, materials, et cetera?
This is two different questions now. I think if you were talking about Operation Jilly, that focused truth,
that was not during
the Cold War. That's later.
All right,
let's talk about the war. Americans had pretty much pulled out of South Korea. Most of our people were going, they were in Japan. When the North Koreans attacked us, and they did a wonderful job, nobody knew they were coming, the CIA, nobody. They didn't tell their own generals they were attacking. And then they gave the orders to go. So they literally caught the United States with its pants down. And it was not unlike the Alamo. We got quickly pushed down to the Busan perimeter. And they were basically told there to hold the die, that we were going to have to get some time. We were going to need time to move troops. They sent an outfit called Task Force Smith in there and basically threw them away, and they just got chopped up. And this is all just getting now to your question. So now this is where we're at. We're losing the war. We're pushed all the way back. North Korea has taken about 90% of the entire country. Everything is looking dark. But MacArthur now wants to use propaganda. He wants to use Psy. At that time, we'll call Psy War. We don't use the term anymore, so it sounds very strange, but we'll use it. So what happened was he had a couple of guys. Now, in World War II, he had done the same thing. He had been sent to the Philippines, and he had no troops there. And he thought he was going to lead an American army, and there was none. So what he did was he took the Australians, who were already doing Psy War, and he just grabbed the Australians, and he pulled them in, and he said, okay, you're now Americans. You're going to fight. We're going to add Americans to you, and we're going to have a thing called the Psychological Warfare Branch, a PWB, and we're going to drop propaganda on the Philippines. And they did so, and they were very successful. Now we got to jump ahead again. Now now he's in Japan. Korea's been attacked. He's got a couple of guys. He's got seven or eight guys there that know a little bit about PSYOP because, again, at the end of the war, we got rid of all of this. There were no PSYOP Corps, to be honest. He's got seven or eight guys that are pretty good. So he makes a little group over in intelligence. Now, this would be 8th Army, and it's called G2. And for you that don't know, we kind of stole that in World War I from the Germans, the German general staff. And G2 is intelligence. So these are the guys that are looking for information. These are the guys that have the map of where the enemy is. And they started within a day after the attack, they were dropping leaflets. He also gave orders that we want to have radio programs out. And within just a very few days of the war, they were, I think, doing about 4 hours a day. So it was really amazing how quickly that was done. But it didn't quite work in some ways because the G2 is intelligence is not really, they don't really do the operations. They basically gather information. So they swapped it over and they sent it to G3. Now, this is still early in the war. This is the first, maybe the about 3 months into the war. So now it goes over to the 8th Army, G3, which is operations. These are the guys that are responsible for getting the trucks, getting the airplanes, printing the leaflets. So operations takes over. So now, for a while, that's all we have. And this is all amateur stuff. This is just being thrown together. Guys being grabbed out of their bunks in the middle of the night and say, did you ever work for a newspaper? Okay, you're now a propagandist. You know, that's what they did. Now, as it becomes clear that we need more people there and better people, they go back to the United States and they find a little outfit and they decide to call out the first leaflet loudspeaker company. Companies are small, a small group. But they were trained, and all of them basically were, if you were a photographer, if you'd ever worked at a radio station, if you were a writer, if you even had taken psychology in college, you found yourself in that outfit. And then they got sent over. So they get sent over. And they start working on the tactical propaganda. I hate to say Psy War, it just killed me. So they were doing tactical because they were a small unit, and they basically, we had talked a little bit about mentioning this, and tactical is just an easy way to answer. Tactical is just small. It's the enemy directly in front of you. So you might call him by name. You might say, this leaflet to the 2nd Division, or you might call individuals by name. If one of their people was captured or defected, you might say that Lieutenant Kim Joe M wishes to speak to his comrades. And then this went on for a bit, and then just shortly after that, then they went even bigger, and they made a group, and that was called the 1st Radio Broadcasting and leaflet group. I hope I'm getting all this right. I'm 84. My mind doesn't work like it used to. So they were strategic. They mostly worked out of Japan, and they would print leaflets there, and they would prepare radio stations, and they would be broadcast to North Korea and later on to China, and they would fly B-29s out of Japan, and they would do the strategic. This is well behind the lines. We're now dropping leaflets on China, deep into North Korea, telling them what a bad idea the war was. So now I'm going to catch my breath, and hopefully you're all with
great.
Me still.
Yeah, and so that was passed, too. I said earlier that Bertha von Suttner said it takes, you know, three times to understand something. So that was passed, too, with tactical and strategic. Okay, so we're still going to really, I hope, get clear on strategic versus tactical versus consolidation. So we're getting there. So this, you had this leaflets and loudspeakers, and then radio, okay? Mm-hmm. And these guys, the small company that you mentioned, the 1st loudspeaker and leaflet company, did those people come from the United States, or were they in Japan?
Yes, everybody. Yeah, no, remember, we had nobody. It's a great story, actually. I wish I could remember their name, but of course, I wasn't kind of expecting you to go this way. There was a little group. We have aggressive war games in the United States, a little where we play, and I used to play the aggressor, and I would be the Russians, and I would attack my own people and mess with them. There was a little outfit that was attached to the aggressor forces that used to leaflet the regular army forces in these games, and they were just basically grabbed, and then just overnight, the unit was beefed up, and it was double, triple in size, and trained up, and sent off to war. But there was nobody in Japan that was going to do this. There was nobody in Korea was going to do this. Even though we took in the Koreans once the group got there, because we needed local experts, we needed people who could speak the language and did different dialects, so they were all kind of drafted and became part of that radio broadcasting and leaflet group.
Great. I'm going to move on to something that you say in one of your articles, and this is linked on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. And by the way, you're listening to Sergeant Major Herbert Friedman, who has many hundreds of articles on Psy War. And in that article, so here we go again with tactical versus strategic. You say, and I quote, "The themes changed frequently according to the tactical situation. The one essential ingredient that never changed was truthfulness." And earlier you mentioned how we lied in the Psy War in Iraq, and also in this book that I've mentioned by Stephen Pease, he says actually that strategic Psy War, quote, "involves propaganda, deliberate lies, or stretching the truth to prejudice minds and international opinion against the opponents." So there are these two, I mean, they seem to be inconsistent claims. One is truthfulness
they
is like first and foremost. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you have to define what you want to call a lie.
There we go.
There's BS. It's truth. So now, when I say lie, the general rule is this. Every book you read, every manual that the Army produces, and there is a stack of them, on the subject will say, don't lie. It's very important to gain credibility. This was a big fight in World War II. If you remember the OSS and the OWI, they tried to make one unit to do propaganda, but one group led by a press fellow, he wanted to only tell the truth. He wanted to do like the BBC, only tell them the truth, gain credibility. The other bunch that was led, the OSS bunch, they wanted to do black stuff. They wanted to use pornography, lies, anything they could in order to harm the war effort. What did Churchill say? That set Europe ablaze with the SOE. So you always have that kind of dichotomy. You have these two sorts. The American rule has always been tell the absolute truth. But then if you read way down to the bottom of the page, the small print might say there will be some occasions when once the people have been trained or taught to believe that we only tell the truth, there might be some occasions when we might want to tell a fib. I was thinking when we spoke a couple of things. One of the more interesting thing was when the British thought the Germans were coming across the Channel, they started dropping propaganda on the Germans that they could set the sea on fire. And they actually showed pictures. They ran big pipes out into the Channel, and they pumped gasoline out and lit it up. And then they dropped all these leaflets, and they said, we're going to teach you how to speak English. Now learn this phrase. The captain is burning. The captain is screaming. The captain is drowning. So basically, once they had set these guys up that they would believe everything you told them, then you would give them the big lie. And this happened, of course, in Normandy. We told them we were coming straight across the Channel. We were going to take the shortest route. But we basically went to Normandy. Our PSYOP people were working day and night. The Ghost Army was making all kinds of sounds. They were making rubber tanks. Patton was being interviewed. Tanks were being moved back and forth. And the Germans were really fooled. Hitler didn't release his panzers for 2 days after the D-Day invasions. In Desert Storm, we told the divisions in Kuwait that we were coming from the sea. We dropped a beautiful leaflet that was designed by a fellow I know named Tim Wallace. It showed this horrible, monstrous Marine coming in from the ocean holding his K-bar knife, which is the issue fighting knife for the Marines. And behind him, you saw helicopters and ships and aircraft carriers. And, of course, that held the several divisions that were just stayed there watching the ocean while Schwarzkopf did that big Hail Mary play, for you to remember it, came around in a big circle and came in behind the Iraqis and basically just beat the hell out of them in 100 hours. So the point I'm getting is that we don't lie, but occasionally, now in Korea, there was a bunch of different plans, and they used to call them name plans. And I'll get to where I'm going. They had one that was called Rat Killer. And there was all these leaflets just talking about the communist guerrillas that were left behind as they retreated. and there was blizzard, and that was trying to restore peace, and there was cities trying to get the North Korean college students to turn against the communist regime. So a lot of these things would use exaggeration. A great theme was to show the Koreans being pushed into the battle, sometimes as a fire, sometimes as a cannon, and the Koreans are being pushed by the Chinese. So they were basically telling the Koreans that while you're fighting at the front, you're fighting for Mao. And by the way, he's taken all the rice out of your country, and he really has eyes on it, really wants to invade and take over Korea. And then we would go a step further. Then we would show the same picture, and now the Koreans being pushed by the Chinese soldier, and behind them he's being pushed by a Russian soldier. And now they would tell the Chinese, you fools that came down here, you volunteers, you know, allegedly, are being fooled by Stalin. Stalin is giving you crappy weapons and crappy clothes and inferior tanks, and he's sending you down to fight, and you're dying for Stalin. So I guess we could call that lies, but see, I don't call that lies. I just call that propaganda.
There you go. I want to just let our listeners know that on the show resources page, there is a link to the Digital Horizons Project, which has just a wonderful collection of these leaflets that were dropped in the Korean War. And some of the leaflets that you're talking about, Sergeant Major Friedman, you can see them there. We've also linked on our show resources page a couple of leaflets that we will be talking about soon. Right. The things that we're saying in this show, like you began talking about how the very term that we use to refer to Psy War has changed. We began with propaganda, then Psy War, PsyOps, MISO, et cetera. And so this like sort of this political nature of language and what is a lie. Last week, we made the show was called something like "Don't Call Them Villages; They Are Military Targets." That comes from a memo that's on our show resources page for last week's show. So I'm just flagging that connection.
Well, when we killed the American Indian, the concept was every child will grow up to be a warrior. So it was never. At least that's the impression I get, that you were basically killing an enemy. In The Godfather, they were looking for the little kid. They were going to kill a kid because they knew he would grow up and he would get a shotgun and come back and seek revenge. So there's a whole philosophy behind killing the children so they don't grow up.
Right, so we're here at this point where we are going to ask you to just... You said before that tactical Psy War, it's like those are the people in front of you. So you address the unit in front of you. And I also want to make a connection to something on our show resources page, which I learned about from my colleague, Dr. Andrew Blom. He's the chairperson of the Department of Philosophy and Religion. He's been on this show before. And he told me that in this HBO series called Watchmen, there is a propaganda leaflet that is dropped on Negro soldiers, and it's addressed to Negro soldiers, to the colored soldiers of the U.S. Army. And so this is an example, I guess, of tactical Psy War.
That's kind of gray, because that's kind of right in between the two, because a lot of time, by the way, this is always done. The Germans did it, the Japanese did it, the Koreans did it, the Vietnamese did it. They know our weaknesses. We know theirs, so we drop leaflets on their Tet, which is their Christmas. They drop leaflets on our Christmas. So, I mean, everybody knows everybody else's weakness. But, there were numerous. The Vietnamese especially, I would give them credit. Every time there was an American politician would talk race, and every time there would be an anti-war demonstration, that would appear on a leaflet that would be using pretty much the same kind of propaganda.
All right. So can you?
So
I just want this distinction between strategic, tactical, and consolidation, and then we can go on to your question, Randy. So tactical is like it's the guy in front of you or the group in front of you.
All right. Let's say 40 miles. I don't believe that, by the way, but they. I know some people said like the first 40 miles. So anybody directly in front of you, and okay. When you see the letters, and you have a couple, you see you showed a few letters. I have about 1,000 of those. The information letter that would go along with the leaflet. It might say if this is requested by the 1st Infantry Division for the 4th North Korean Division that it's opposite its front lines. And then they would tell you what they wanted, and then you would write it. And they would say something like, we fought you 2 weeks ago, and we beat the hell out of you. We took 400 prisoners, and we know you lost over 1,000 men. Why are you coming back for more? So that would be a tactical leaflet. They're directly in front of you, and you're trying to impress them and trying to get them to decide not to attack, to do anything but fight.
And strategic?
And again, the strategic is for the enemy country. The strategic would be for, in this case, would be for North Korea, would be for China, would be even maybe for Russia. You would be using leaflets that attack those countries and their philosophy, their politics, maybe the way they were taking food from the Korean people, taking the women, making the Koreans into their servants, working for them, that sort of thing. Consolidation is always about rebuilding the country, bringing it back to normal. You got to remember, most of these countries that we go and we occupy, we want to get the hell out of there. We don't really want to stay there forever. So you use these consolidation leaflets to try to get them back on, build their economy up. I mean, my God, this country almost destroyed itself building up Germany and Japan after World War II. They had brand new factories built by the Marshall Plan. We couldn't compete with them. People don't often mention that, but that's part of the consolidation. Build them up, put them back in their feet so we can get the hell out and let you defend yourself. We have troops in Korea. We have a division there that, of course, is billions of dollars since the 1950s. We never brought them home. And it would be nice to bring them back and get them out of there. But it may never happen because North Korea is still considered a threat. They talk like they're a threat, and so perhaps they are. Go ahead.
All right, Randy, you had a question?
Yeah, so at the beginning, we had this this narrative get constructed about how propaganda has been used for a very long time, and it's changed name, and the methodology has evolved. And I'm interested in dragging our conversation, you know, all the way to the present and seeing if we can tie any knots between, you know, the kinds of technological innovations that have passed through. You know, we've gone through some big changes in the last 20 years, and that inevitably has a consequence on the kinds of tactics that can be used for psychological operations. And I'd be interested to hear Sergeant Major Friedman's thoughts about, I guess first, like just broad strokes, like, you know, what kinds of stuff is getting used today, both, you know, on all sides of conflicts, like what kinds of stuff has emerged over time?
All right.
And then we can drill a little deeper.
All right. I believe I'm talking to Randy, right?
Yes.
Get the right fella? Okay,
yep.
Randy, when you get a chance, look up my article on dissemination. that's exactly what I wrote about, all the ways you can disseminate propaganda. But number one, of course, the number one is always leaflets, because leaflets are easy, they're cheap, they don't cost hardly anything. You can print a million, an average drop is sometimes 2 and 3 million leaflets. They say in Vietnam, they dropped enough leaflets to go to the moon and back about 16 times, you know, whatever the number was. They were just basically trying to say it was a big, big number. So you drop leaflets, you can put any message on a leaflet. You can drop it with fair accuracy from the air. Not great, even though people during the Cold War, the people got really involved in dropping leaflets on Korea. And I had one fellow tell me, "Oh, I could fly 35 miles out at sea and drop letters on Kim's doorstep," you know, which I thought he was exaggerating a bit, but maybe he could, you know, maybe he could. So that's the leaflet. Then, of course, you know, you have the loudspeaker. Loudspeaker can be taken up on tanks, can be taken on jeeps, can be backpacked, carried in. and of course the aircraft. So aircraft was a great problem because nobody could hear the damn things because they didn't like getting shot at, so they flew too high. So eventually they figured out they had to fly at about 2,000 feet, but they said, we ain't going to do it. So everybody compromised, and they flew at about 4,000 feet. So there, and that's still around. That's still being used. That's very good in crowd control. That's good in Iraq when you want to search a village or something, and you don't want to threaten and terrify the people and have them maybe shoot. You just tell them, we're just coming in. This is very peaceful. We'd just like you to come out. We're just looking for weapons. So that's used. And it's also used in prison camps to try to keep the prisoners under control by giving them constant communication. Then we have radio. The problem with radio, of course, is that quite often our radio can't reach them. And in Afghanistan, it was all mountainous, and you couldn't reach them. So what do? We give them the radios. We drop them in I don't think we dropped them in Korea. We dropped them in Vietnam. In all our desert wars, we've given them. We do sometimes give them as prize when they go to visit Mecca, and we would tell them like, "Well, we'd like to give you a nice present for that," and we give them a radio. And of course, for the most part, the radios were designed so they can only hear our message. They didn't have a lot of different stations on them. And then as we get more currently now, we're getting into social media. The military is starting to look into that. We're getting into the telephone. We're getting into all the various ways to use the cell phones. For instance, when we attacked Iraq, all the generals were basically called up by the Allied armies. They were called up and said, if you lay down your arms and if you don't fight, we will not kill you. All we want to do is throw out Saddam and his political party. And a lot of them did that. We're using drones very much, drones for photographs. Drones can be used as weapons. Drones can drop leaflets. We've used balloons. Balloons are kind of going out of style, but they're still using them in Korea. They're using them north and south. They'll fly balloons at each other. They use them in East Germany. They use them in China and Taiwan. They fly balloons back and forth at each other. We also have rockets. The Germans in World War II put leaflets on V-1 rockets. They also, small rockets were fired back and forth across the lines into Berlin, the West and the East. So I think I kind of answered your question. I don't want to go. I can't just come up with every single thing we've done. But any form of communication today, whether it be Trump and his tweets and all, they're all being pretty much used as propaganda.
Okay. Any other questions before I move on to a very specific leaflet that you can access on our show resources page? Any other questions, comments about these memes? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just sort of along the general vein of the Korean War. So, Sergeant Master Friedman, I know in various other wars, in Vietnam War, there was Hanoi Hannah. In Japan in World War II, there was Tokyo Rose, Baghdad Betty in the Iraq War, and Axis Sally in World War II. So I was just curious, off the top of your head, if there's any sort of concentrated personality during the Korean War who was a main sort of catalyst for this propaganda.
I don't recall anyone in particular. Of course, I've got two articles on radio, and I mentioned all those, and even more people, Lord Haw Haw. There are plenty of people. But I don't think there was much of that in Korea. First of all, most of the speakers, if they did do that, would be speaking Korean. They'd be talking to the South Koreans, so we wouldn't be aware of them that much anyway. But I don't, if you're asking me, were there any English-speaking Koreans, I do not recall any.
Yeah, I don't recall coming across that either in my research. Okay, so let's turn to the safe conduct pass. And you can, this is an actual leaflet that was dropped, and you can access that on our show resources page. And Sergeant Major Friedman, can you talk about the safe conduct pass? And I know that this was a kind of leaflet that was used in multiple conflicts.
Yeah. Well, of course, I hate to say this because it sounds like a broken record, but I've got three articles on that subject. One on the pass of shame, which was the German safe conduct pass, the official one signed by Eisenhower. One on the IC's resistance pass, because the Japanese did not like the word surrender. It got them very aggravated. So we asked the Japanese to surrender by simply saying IC's resistance, and you can Google that with my name. And during the Vietnam War, we had an official safe conduct pass that at first had five flags, and then as more allied countries joined, we went to seven flags. And then when we left there, we made a one flag when we used that Vietnamization concept, which led to their demise pretty quickly. So, yes, the safe conducts are always one of the major themes. I mean, that's always right up on top of it. In any war, you always want the enemy to come over and you promise him food, you promise him safety, he'll be taken to the rear, he will not be put in any jeopardy. When we deal with people who deal with faith, then we tell them that you will not be embarrassed in any way. We will not take away your souvenirs. We won't take away your watch. But they're always used now. And Korea had a lot of them because, first of all, there was a lot of different leaders in Korea. We started with MacArthur, and then he just drove Truman crazy. Truman fired him. And I remember, by the way, I was there the day that he did his speech and about old soldiers never die. And I saw him driving around in Central Park in New York. And at the time, we all hated Truman. And how could that little haberdasher have fired this wonderful hero? But then as years went on and we read more and more about MacArthur, it became very understandable. But so we had many of them signed by MacArthur. There was a whole cult of MacArthur started in World War II. And it's remained in Korea. Letters written by him and pictures of him. Then we had Van Fleet, and then we had General Mark Clark, and we had General Ridgway. So all these various generals all produced safe conduct passes. The most interesting I saw was in banknotes. As I said earlier, I liked currency. Mm-hmm. We produced a Korean money that had safe conduct pass signed by these various generals on the back. I really like those a lot. And of course, I wrote an article on them, need I say, on Korean banknote propaganda.
I wanted to say, if you're interested in an actual banknote leaflet, there, I believe there's one on eBay right now for about $100.
Yeah, you'll see them quite often. There's not a great demand for them. They're probably worth about $15-$20. Leaflets are not in great demand. The only leaflets that are really in demand are the really horrible leaflets that are produced black. Now, I meant to say before, I had it in my notes to don't forget to tell them. There are three kinds of leaflets, basically, and I'm sure that Hope knows this. And by the way, I wish you guys would call me Herb. You're driving me crazy. The white leaflet is a leaflet that's clearly defined. The enemy knows it came from us. Sometimes they'll even have a code number on that clearly denotes it from us. And that's a white leaflet. That's the kind the U.S. Army does. They're white. Everybody knows who did them. There are gray leaflets. Gray leaflets don't always mention us. There were newspapers that we dropped in Korea. There were newspapers in World War II and in every war. My voice is starting to go. And those are great. They don't actually mention us. Everybody kind of knows they're from us because they saw the American bomber go over, but they don't mention it. And then there's black. Now, the military does not touch these. These are civilian in nature. These are that famous three-letter organization makes these, you know. And they're just horrible. They're bestiality. They're dead. Sex with dead bodies. Sex with animals. Sex with children. And those are the ones that people will pay hundreds of dollars for because only the crazies out there just love that. The more gory they are, the more they're liked. But the black leaflets, the ones that nobody would take credit for, and even the British did one. And the British, are so coy about it and never want to talk about any such thing. It's just horrible. It's a dastardly act. they show a foreign worker that's been brought to Germany to work having sex with a beautiful blonde. And they're telling the Germans that while you're fighting at the front, they're moving in these swarthy Italians and these Spaniards and these, you know, Slavs, and they're having sex with your wife. So those are the ones that are really hot. Those are the ones that cost money. Now, let me just throw one more at you that you're not even going to believe. There were a lot of stamps made, and stamp collectors are very, just love their stamps, and they have a need to be complete. There was a German sheet that is very similar to the Hitler birthday sheet, you know, celebrating his birthday, of course. And they sell for somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000. They're nothing but a leaflet, but they have a couple of stamps on, and if you collect German stamps, you got to have that OSS stamp. And of course, you'll find that, too. I have an article called Cornflakes about that was an OSS black plan to have every German have mail on his breakfast table, just like he eats his cornflakes. And we show a lot of that. And these things literally go for I had a friend of mine bought one for $34,000, and he was really, really happy. And it's worth about 12 cents in actual value. You know, it's a piece of paper with a little printing on it. But because the collectors must be complete, that's a valuable leaflet. Back to you.
All right. So since we're talking about leaflets, I would like to just go to these, you're talking about various themes. And we do have a clip so we can, you know, get our voices back and so forth. But this is a clip that is from a film. You can access it on our show resources page. It's called Psychological Warfare, a Combat Weapon in Korea. It was made by the Department of Defense probably around 1951-ish. I can't remember the exact date, but the National Archives has recently restored it, and you can watch the entire film on our show resources page. This is a clip where they're talking about how a theme was selected for these leaflets in the Korean War. It's about a minute and 20 seconds, so here is the clip.
In the selection of a theme, many factors must be considered. Does it capture the interest of the audience? Does it hold that interest? Above all, does it establish confidence in what we're saying? A theme has been selected. The theme is needless death. First, an artist prepares a dramatic piece of art, and the theme comes to life with a grief-stricken mother, visualizing the pointless death of her soldier son. Two versions are prepared, one for the Koreans and one for the Chinese. By using overlays, special care can be given to the varying details of the soldier's gun and uniform. Even a small inaccuracy may create a wave of ridicule among the enemy and destroy the effect of months of previous propaganda. The text that goes with the picture is first written in English. With the help of an interpreter, it is then translated into both Korean and Chinese. Short, punchy words make their point quickly and fan the soldier's feeling of despair. He is fed the thought that he will soon join the swelling victims of needless death.
So that is the clip from, again, Psychological Warfare, a Combat Weapon in Korea. And do you have any general comments, Sergeant Major Friedman, Herb, about
It's pretty straightforward. And you notice that he did say that you can't have any mistakes, and you really can't lie again. So, I mean, we're not talking about exaggeration. You can't out-and-out lie. But there were numerous things. The funny part about that particular kind of leaflet is that there was one in Vietnam, and I was looking at it one day, and then I said, "Gee, that looks familiar." And I looked at Korea, and it was the same mother. It was the same woman looking at her dead son. They just they just changed the propaganda. But there was lots of those sorts of things, and always. But we did a lot in Japan because they wouldn't surrender. In Japan, we had to basically tell them, you have to rebuild your country. Don't commit suicide. We never cared if the officers killed themselves, but we would tell the enlisted soldiers, you have to stay alive to rebuild your country. So we really tried to keep them alive. And we did that in just about every war.
Hmm. All right, well, we've been going for an hour, and so we're going to have to wrap up fairly quickly. And I wanted to mention one more leaflet, which seems to be in a different category. And this leaflet is also on our show resources page. You will find it with the safe conduct pass. And I'm just going to call these warning leaflets. And, you know, for the past few weeks, we've been talking about aerial bombardment. And there were warning leaflets dropped from planes warning civilians that, you know, flee the area, you're about to be bombed. The warning leaflet that we have on our show resources page is warning refugees not to cross the Han River. And I'm wondering, Sergeant Major Friedman, can you talk about these different types of leaflets, these warning leaflets?
Well, the bomb warnings have a long and glorious history. And much as I hate to do this, we have to go back to World War II. And the concept was first came out by, I'm not going to mention names. We started dropping leaflets on the Japanese, telling them that we would mention like 12 cities, and we would tell them 40 cities is going to be bombed and completely destroyed. Now, why do you do that? Well, there's two things. Number one, if you want to look at one side, the nice side, you could say, well, we're saving their lives. We're telling them to clear out. But you could also look at it from, let's say, the darker side, if you use the force, Luke, and say that, number one, this is going to stop their factory. It's going to stop their economy, because if they believe their city is going to be bombed, they will run. They will pile out into the roads and not allow any kind of traffic to move, and just stop the entire North Korean army. So, I like to think that we did it for the proper reason. So we did it there. MacArthur did it with his own in the Philippines, in Korea. We dropped a lot of these. There was a planned strike, it was called. And all of the strike leaflets were all about bombing. We basically told people, don't repair the roads, because if we bomb the roads and you repair them, they're going to bomb up again and you'll be killed. We told them, stay away from the bridges, stay away from railroad tracks. And we always said that we were doing this to save lives. But I always think we might have had a little bit of an ulterior motive. But there's no doubt that if they listened, their lives were saved.
Mm. All right. I think, Randy, did you have a question before that you didn't get?
Drilling into this idea of, like, the necessity for honesty, or at least partial honesty, in the process of establishing credibility, so that the psychological things would not just fall apart, like, you know, why would people believe us if we lied last time, kind of thing. You know, we live in a world where it's difficult to determine whether things are true at all, and there's like the term fake news is just ever-present, omnipresent idea nowadays. And I'm in this strange position where I suspect that if 1,000 leaflets fell on my lawn today that said, you know, I have to evacuate because a disaster is coming, I have a feeling most of my neighbors would just stay inside and ignore it. And I'm wondering, like, you know, is this the result of some kind of psychological operation? Like what's going on?
Well, as I said right at the start of this whole thing, nobody knows why people do things, and that's why it's so hard to sell psychological operations to some people, you know, some combat leaders. And one of my favorite examples is that they had dropped thousands of leaflets on certain enemy groups trying to get them to surrender, and one fellow did come over, and this is a true story, and they were so happy, and they brought out the leaflets, and they sat them down, and they said, which one of our leaflets did you read? What argument did we make that tempted you, you know, to come over? And he said, I haven't had sex in 6 months, and we're not allowed to have sex because they're good communists. But the commissar, who is the political officer, has his girlfriend every day. And so I said, the hell with it, and I left. So, yeah, I mean, just try to think about the psychologist that wrote these leaflets, and he suddenly finds out that the reason he got a guy to surrender was because he couldn't have sex. So I find that kind of comical, and you never really know what's going to get them. Usually, if they're sick enough, if they're hungry enough, they'll obey. Right now, look at this whole COVID thing. We got half this country thinking COVID's killing everybody, and we're in terrible, dire danger. And we got half the country thinking it's a Democratic plot to make Trump lose the election because of the loss of the American economy and unemployment. So you're right. There is no way to tell what's true anymore.
Sounds about right.
Wow, food for thought. Michael, anything?
Oh, no, I've truly enjoyed everything that I've had to hear from Sergeant Major Friedman. Thank you so much for coming on. I truly learned a lot about a really interesting subject.
Yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I really try to keep it light and keep it low because it is. It's just another job. There are people who think this is magic. There are people who think this is voodoo. A couple of years ago, I remember some senator was going to visit an Army base, and they appointed a PSYOP officer to take him around. I got about 4 or 5 phone calls that was in a day from CNN and NBC. You know, are they going to psych him? I said, there's no such thing as psyching. They're going to ask him, what do you like to drink? Do you like cigars? Do you like girls? Do you like boys? Well, you know, they're going to do exactly what you do in big business when the boss comes down, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was this wonderful concept that this PSYOP is magic, and you can change minds. You could say something, you know, the Russians won the election. What Hillary fan in the world is going to vote for Trump, regardless of what the Russians say, and what Trump fan is going to vote for Hillary? It's clear that some things just can't be moved. But sometimes if you can hit the right spot and get them right where you want them at exactly the right time, then you can't move. You can move a person. You can change your mind.
Surrender is a process. On that note, we didn't, I just want to, we don't have time to go into it because we're over our time, but these days, as you mentioned, Herb, there are balloons being flown by both sides, although not so much from the south anymore. I'm not going to say anything more than that. Maybe we'll come back and talk about that in detail. But we are sadly out of time. And, yeah, I've learned so much. And thank you for taking time to be with us. And please, listeners, look at our show resources page. There's so much important information there. The film that I mentioned, Psychological Warfare, produced by the Department of Defense, is really, really compelling, as well as this collection of leaflets from the Digital Horizons Project. Good night and good luck. And you've been listening to Virtues of Peace. So if you want to say goodbye, now's the time. And I'm going to say goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
I think we should go for a 10-mile run with a full backpack. What do you say, guys?
Sounds about
as long as you wear a mask. I'm kidding. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Bye-bye.
There you go.